Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we have narrated history episodes, and we also have episodes where we sit down with filmmakers, authors, politicians, and historians to talk about the wars in history. We are very honored to have today's guest, Lord Jonathan Sumption, who is here with us. He is a former justice of the UK Supreme Court and one of the most respected legal figures in Britain. He is a fellow of the Royal Historical Society and a renowned, wonderful historian who's written an epic five-volume history of the 100 Years' War. And today we're going to be covering Volume 5, The 100 Years' War, Triumph and Illusion. I am really excited to have him here today. Lord Sumption, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Yes, so first of all, I've got to say, five volumes. That's pretty epic.
It's taken 43 years of my life. I did a few other things at the same time, but it's a large chunk of what I've done with myself.
As a former justice, were you used to just writing a lot about kind of just everything that you were into? You must write a lot.
Well, I don't write about everything. I've written a lot of judgments in my life and a lot of history. The Hundred Years' War it lasted 120 years, slightly more, and it's not easy to write about briefly. There are lots of people who've written this or that theory but about particular aspects of the war, but really the striking thing is that without a really detailed grounding in the facts of what actually happened, it's very difficult to know why or to expound any great theories about it. So I thought that since this was a gap, it's one that I ought to try to fill. One of the problems is that this was a war between two of the most nationalistic countries in Europe. So, and each of them has their own narrative. French historians have tended to write about those periods of the war when they were doing well, and English historians prefer the periods when they were doing well. So you basically have a disconnect with large gaps in the historical writing, and that's what I've tried to fill. I've tried to write a neutral history of the whole war from both sides.
I was very pleased when I opened the book to see that it was almost 1,000 pages, just this one volume alone, Volume 5. And if you're into that era of the Hundred Years' War, you're definitely going to get information that you're looking for if you open one of your volumes. And I just have to say, I love how you opened it up by mentioning the Wheel of Fortune, this like ever-present symbol of the turnings of the fate of mankind and the fortunes of mankind. I feel like that's very fitting for the Hundred Years' War, ups and downs.
It's not a modern idiom, is it? We have tried to abolish the Wheel of Fortune, not very successfully. We don't accept that there's such a thing as bad luck. It's just malice and ill-doing if things have gone wrong. That was not the view of medieval men. They thought that there were capricious forces at work for which nobody might be to blame.
And you can see that a lot in these tapestries and these illustrations and the old records, as the Wheel of Fortune comes across a lot too. And so just for our listeners who might not be super familiar with the Hundred Years' War, can you give us just a really brief overview of this is what we're talking about, when we're talking about?
It was an epic series of wars, which began, by most orthodox reckonings, in the 1330s and ended in the 1850s. The two main belligerents were England and France, but it also involved Scotland, which was then a separate country. It involved the Low Countries, corresponding to what in today it is Belgium and Holland. It involved Germany, it involved Italy, and it very much involved Spain and Portugal. So it was really a war involving the whole of Western Europe. And it's difficult to summarize the issues in a single sentence, but basically it grew out of the fact that the English kings were also noblemen who possessed about a third of France. And this brought them into conflict with the kings of France, who tried to exercise authority over the parts of France ruled by the English kings in a way that the English kings found very difficult to tolerate. So it was an attempt really to separate the areas of France that were ruled by the English kings to separate them from the French crown. At various times, the English kings also claimed to be the rightful kings of France, and they came quite close to achieving that in the early 15th century. But in the end, this was a conflict between England, and which was a middling rank power, and the largest, most populous, and richest state in Europe. And it was one that they were never going to win in the long run.
Yeah. And, you know, I wanted to ask, as an American, we tend to think of like, oh, there's just England and France, and we don't really think of the other countries involved. Over on the other side of the pond, on your side of the pond, do Brits generally know that Scotland was involved in the Hundred Years' War and Belgium and all these other countries?
No, they don't. Huh. And neither do the French. I mean, one of the missing dimensions of most historical writing on these wars is the dimension of other countries. Because, Scotland was a major participant. Not only were there wars across the border between England and Scotland, but the Scots sent whole contract armies to fight in France for the French. And it's the same with the Portuguese and the Spanish. Castile, which is the major part of what is now Spain, was an important belligerent. John of Gaunt, the uncle of the King of England, claimed to be King of Castile and actually invaded Castile to try and make his claim good. The English fought in alliance with the Portuguese kings, landing armies in Portugal. They landed armies in what is now Holland. English companies of mercenaries fought in Italy and in Switzerland and in Germany. It was a multinational war.
It feels like there's a rabbit hole almost. You could just study this forever just to learn and understand how many players were involved. And obviously you spent 40 years writing about it, so you're like, yeah, I know. But I have to ask, what was it like getting sources, first-hand accounts, or was that difficult?
Well, there are very few first-hand accounts in the sense of eyewitnesses, but the sources really fall into two groups. There are chroniclers who were basically like the newspapers of today, and like the newspapers of today, some of them are a lot more reliable than others. And then there were the records, the administrative records of the various states involved. And they are generally by far the most reliable sources. The problem is not that many of them have been printed in book form. So you have to consult them in manuscript in various archives spread across Europe. The general rule in history is that the more unselfconscious a source is, the more reliable it is. By unselfconscious, I mean that when you've got a source which has a propagandist purpose, it has an obvious bias. The most reliable sources are sources that were written by people who had absolutely no interest in the facts that they were describing. For example, one of the major sources for the course of these wars is accounting evidence. Now, these documents were actually devised in order to ensure that people accounted properly for public money that they'd been given. But they contain a whole host of details about what this money was spent on. Now, these are very reliable sources because they were produced by very humble accounts clerks who frankly didn't care a fig about the war and they had no bias at all. All they wanted to know was how much they'd given to Sam and what he spent it on.
Love it. It's interesting because one of my favorite subjects of medieval propaganda is Richard III, and you could just see that so strongly when Henry Tudor came in and he's like, let's write a bunch of bad stuff about Richard III to make him look really bad. And I feel like it just exemplifies that.
First English monarchs who had a coherent propagandist story about the wickedness of the predecessors that they'd displaced. That hadn't been very common before. I mean, it happened occasionally,
really?
But it was not on that scale.
That's fascinating. Okay, so on the subject of the Hundred Years' War, some of the bigger figures that we know about are Joan of Arc, for instance. Everybody at least knows a little bit about her story. But I wanted to ask, from your viewpoint as a Supreme Court justice, how fairly or unfairly was she treated during her trial? Like, really?
Well, she was charged with what we in the 21st century would regard as a non-existent offence, namely witchcraft. And it was necessary to the English to convict her, because both sides were agreed that what she did could only have been done with the aid of miraculous powers. The difference between the two sides was that the English believed that these miraculous powers were derived from Satan, and the French believed, along with Joan of Arc herself, that they were derived from God. So if they were derived from God, that rather suggested that the English had no right to be in France. So
right.
It was actually very important to the English to establish that she was a witch and a heretic who derived her successors from the support of Satan. Now, in that sense, of course, she didn't get a fair trial at all. Mm. The trial was conducted in the same way as most criminal and inquisitorial trials were conducted in the late Middle Ages. All criminal proceedings in the late Middle Ages are likely to strike us today as being extremely unfair. Joan's was no exception.
Yeah, anytime that you read about medieval trials, it's kind of shocking, actually, how things used to be in the Star Chambers and all sorts of stuff. So I wanted to ask, too, about another figure. There's part of the Hundred Years' War that sounds so crazy, this event, that it almost could come out of a fairy tale, where there's a story of Edward III. And there's like the siege of Calais, and he's ordered like all the important men in the town to be executed, but then he's stopped at the last moment. Did that happen? That doesn't sound real.
Something like that probably did happen, but the details may well have been embroidered. There's only one source for that incident. It's a very famous incident in French mythology, and it is portrayed in a very well-known sculpture by the late 19th, early 20th century sculptor Auguste Rodin, The Burghers of Calais. The only source that we have for it was a chronicle written by a chronicler from Hainaut called Jean Le Bel. He was not always totally reliable, and it's always tempting, since he liked a good story, to accept his good stories. I think that something theatrical like this could well happen, but I don't actually think you can put it stronger than that.
Yeah, reading about it, I'm like, this sounds like Brothers Grimm, just like not really the way maybe it went down.
It's more likely to have happened in the 14th century than it would be to happen in the 20th, say. Habits have changed.
Yeah, definitely. And another big figure, you can't talk about the Hundred Years' War without at least mentioning Henry V.
No, that's true.
Why do you think we know Battle of Agincourt more than any of the other huge things that he did?
One reason why we know a lot about the Battle of Agincourt is that it's such a seminal event in the history of English patriotism. And that, of course, is embodied in the play about Henry V by Shakespeare. Shakespeare has had a most extraordinary influence on the perception of these wars in English language countries, because Shakespeare's command of English is such a remarkable thing. In France, Shakespeare is less influential, and Agincourt is not the subject of quite so much reverence, quite apart from the fact that it was a major French defeat.
Yeah.
And so speaking of battles, you called the Battle of Verneuil the bloodiest fight in the war. Can you tell us why that is?
First of all, the Battle of Verneuil happened in 1424. It was a battle between the regent of the English regent of France, who effectively ruled most of the northern part of France, John, Duke of Bedford, and the young Charles VII. He wasn't actually present, but his generals were, and his army consisted partly of Scottish mercenaries, partly of Italian cavalrymen, and to only a minor extent of French soldiers. It was the reason it was a very bloody fight was that the armies were roughly the same size and they had comparable weapons, because the Scots fought on principles very similar to the English, and they were the only people apart from the English who used longbows. So you have an evenly matched group. In addition, no prisoners were taken, because the English hated and very much resented the role that the Scots were playing in reviving French military power, and the Scots had long-standing historical grievances against the English. So the casualties on both sides were extremely high. Ultimately, it was an English victory, and the French had been expected to win, and many people were prepared to defect from English loyalty to French as a result. So
really?
It was a considerable shock when the English won. And
yeah.
It basically established their position in northern France for the next 5 or 6 years, until Joan of Arc.
Would it be fair to say there's a lot of emotion involved in the people fighting?
Well, that wasn't always true, but it certainly was in that battle, largely because of the long-standing hostility of England and Scotland, which was much more intense than the hostility of England and France.
Yeah. And I love asking this when we hop into different periods of warfare on this podcast. Do you think that there was any changes in the style of warfare and fighting during the Hundred Years' War? Did that change how people fought each other?
On the actual tactical side? Well, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, there were important technological changes that happened in the course of this war. But for a start, the longbow, which was the decisive weapon in the early battles, became less significant later. Crossbows, which were the French propulsive weapon of choice, were considerably improved in the course of the war, largely because the original bows, which were made of laminated slices of wood, were replaced by steel bows, which had much greater penetration and range. Other changes were tactical changes, such as whether you fought on foot or on horseback, and if you fought on horseback, what kind of lance you used. And of course, the major change was the introduction, about halfway through the war, of field artillery, gunpowder artillery, which was, in the early examples, very inaccurate, but became more accurate and became more lethal and acquired a longer range as the war got on.
Oh, fantastic changes. I mean, horrible changes, but fantastically interesting. So obviously everybody knows that a little bit after this, there's the Wars of the Roses, and that Game of Thrones is very much based on the Wars of the Roses. But the Hundred Years' War kind of seems like it could fit in that world, almost Game of Thrones-ish, where it's sometimes very brutal.
Well, the Wars of the Roses were, in a sense, a direct continuation of the Hundred Years' War, because the shattering and morale-breaking defeat of the English in the early 1450s led to tremendous recriminations and ultimately to civil war in England.
And do you think that it was more or less brutal than other wars at the time, or was it just kind of like the same as other wars?
Not particularly brutal by the standard of contemporary wars. They were, and they certainly, the casualties were largely confined to people who fought in the armies, whereas in the Hundred Years' War, that most of the casualties were innocent civilians who were simply massacred because they were in the way.
I wanted to ask about the average person during the Hundred Years' War. Do you think the average person in England was like, this whole thing going on, let's get on with our day? Or were people on average in turmoil and under threat?
They weren't in turmoil, except briefly at crises of the war. The war was brought home to non-combatants in both England and France in different ways. They had no newspapers, but the armies crossed France, causing immense damage to property and lives. And so the ubiquity of armed men in the French countryside was a source of continual instability and insecurity. None of the fighting, except for a few coastal raids, happened in England itself. But the war was nevertheless very present to the English because, first of all, it involved the recruitment of soldiers. Secondly, it involved the levying of much heavier taxes than the English had been used to. Thirdly, it involved constant news coming from the battlefront in the form not of newspapers but of newsletters written, which were copied and out and spread around. There were royal proclamations that expressed in somewhat exaggerated and propagandist form the dangers that were round the corner. So not many people would have been ignorant of the fact that there was a major war going on, and most people would have had some inkling of what was going on. After major successful battles, the English kings would return to England and would receive tumultuous welcomes, mainly in London, from people who were very well informed about what had happened.
And do you think that it was quite a shock how it turned out for the English people?
It was a shock because the English had won most of the battles but lost the war, and they found it difficult to understand how that could be so. The answer, of course, was that battles didn't decide all that much. What decided the outcome of wars was, first of all, the disparity of resources between the two sides, and secondly, the ability of the English to hold on to actual territory in France.
And do you think that overall we have more of a French slant on what we know about the war, or more of an English slant?
The tendency has been for English historians to write about the English experience and French historians to write about the French experience. I recently read an account of French history in the 15th century, which certainly dwelt upon the violence of daily life, but hardly mentioned the fact that it happened because of the English. And equally, there are biographies of Henry V that hardly mention the French except as people who occasionally were massacred. And one of the objects that I've had in writing these books is to explain how the war affected both sides.
And I just have a couple extra questions here. This is one of my favorite questions to ask historians. Are there any hotly debated questions or topics about the Hundred Years' War that just people just go back and forth on still?
Many. First of all, on the English side, there's a constant argument among scholars about what the English king's objects were. What were their war aims? In particular, what were the war aims of Edward III? What did they really expect to achieve? Of course, they had lots of claim, but what did they really think they might get out of these wars? And that's, you know, that has always been much debated. Then there are obviously arguments about what determines the outcome of the wars, whether the French were all anti-English in the 15th century, whether the English were ruined. The English actually occupied most of northern France for some 30 years in the 15th century. And there's much argument among scholars about whether this was a bit like the German occupation of France in the 1940s.
Really?
Whether the French objected to the English. I mean, the truth is that while the English were doing well, the French, under their rule, were perfectly happy to be ruled by them. When things started falling...
Really?
Oh, yes. This was not a very nationalistic age. An extremely prominent and observant advisor to King Charles VII of France once observed that people really cared about the quality of government. And if they received a fair administration and just courts, they would be prepared to support the government. A lot of subjects of Charles VII thought that it was outrageous that people born in France should be prepared to be ruled by English kings. Actually, they were perfectly prepared to be ruled by English kings, provided that they were well ruled by them. And they were for a time, but the trouble about this was that it was bound to come to an end, because when, you know, the war itself destroys the fabric of government, and the result of that was that the English government became much less effective, it was much less good at protecting French people from the perils of war than it had previously been, and that of course dissolved what had previously been quite strong loyalties to the English. I mean, some towns there was a great deal of support for English rule right up to the bitter end.
Wow. I mean, it does sound, you know, that Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where your basic needs are just don't imprison us unjustly, don't rule us badly, before people start caring about who's ruling them.
It's more complicated than that, because what you have to bear in mind is that throughout this period, France was divided by bitter civil wars, but from between different groups of Frenchmen. And it was because of these civil wars that the English had been able to achieve such successes as they had. And if you take the 15th century, for example, the reigns of Henry V and Henry VI, France was bitterly divided before the English had even set foot in the country. And basically, what the French said was they were fed up of civil war. They felt that if the English kings were in a position to rule the whole of France and to restore peace, then it was worth having them. And for a time, it seemed that they might be. It didn't happen that way. The French managed to set up separate governments in the southern half of France, which the English hadn't occupied. And once that happened, the dream of uniting France and bringing peace under a powerful English dynasty faded, and people turned against the English.
Wow. I mean, you don't really think about civil war in France at this time. That's really interesting. And my last question would be, so you've written 5 volumes on the Hundred Years' War, thousands of pages and decades of research. Is there any lingering question that you just haven't been able to solve in all of this research?
Well, I just don't ask myself that question. I've written the books now, and there's nothing more I can do about it. I'm sure that in years to come, people will spend a lot of time picking my account to pieces and suggesting that I have overlooked this or got that wrong. That's the fate of all historical writers, and I don't expect I will be any exception.
Well, it does sound pretty good that you don't have any, like, oh, I just can't solve this one thing. So I want to thank you again for coming on this show and answering all these questions. And I may be pushing our luck here, but I wanted to ask if you have any plans on any future books.
Yes, I'm going to write about another period of French civil wars, the French Wars of Religion.
Really?
In the second half of the 16th century.
Oh, that is awesome. Do you know when we might see that book from you?
Well, I've agreed to give the manuscript to my publishers by the end of 2029. But you have to remember that when I contracted to write about the Hundred Years' War, I was going to finish it in 15 years, not 43. So an author's predictions as to when he's going to finish a book are the last thing that you should ever take at face value.
That's true. I've heard that before. Okay, but that is really cool. I love to see what you write about that when that comes out. So
sooner or later, I dare say you will.
Oh, yes. Okay, cool. Well, Lord Jonathan Sumption, author of The 100 Years' War, written in 5 epic volumes. You can find them anywhere that you find books. Thank you again so much for being here.
It's a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye.